This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new unrivaled league, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The NFL did change three rules today. The tush push was not banned. That got tabled until the spring league meeting coming up in Minneapolis in late May. That's the one when Josh Harris ended up being voted in and becoming the owner of the Commanders. But the rules that did get passed, touchbacks on kickoffs going to move from the 30 to the 35, try to cut down on touchbacks, make teams kick the ball so that it gets returned. Both teams are going to get the ball in overtime in the regular season, which is long, long overdue. They just recently started having that rule in the playoffs. Now they'll do it in regular season as well. And then they expanded replay assist, which is great. That's a huge win as far as I'm concerned. Dana, I know you like this. You're going to be able to reverse flags that are thrown. If it's not thrown, you can't add a flag after the fact. But based on penalties thrown in-game by officials, face masks, horse collars, defenseless receiver, running or roughing the kicker, tripping, those types of things, the eye in the sky will be able to correct the bad calls made by officials in-game. But let's give away some tickets. Caller number 10 at 800-636-1067. Congrats, you're going to win a pair of tickets to a show of your choosing. You get to pick what you see. 2025 Wolf Trap season schedule coming up this summer at Wolf Trap. James Taylor, Steve Winwood, Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows, Part 2 in concert with the National Symphony Orchestra, just to name a few of the shows. Congrats to the winner. Caller 10 right now, 800-636-1067.
This radio program right here, we're exclusively sponsored by the law firm of Condori and Morab, estate planning, elder law, real estate transactions, probate administration. Their attorneys are always there to protect you and your family's assets. Schedule a free consultation with their team today by visiting kmlawyers.com and be sure to let them know that we sent you. That's kmlawyers.com.
It is time for our Beltway Blitz, and on a busy day in D.C. sports, we're going to cover the Nationals, who play in Toronto tonight, and the Commanders, who have been busy talking this week. Peters yesterday, Quinn today. But let's start you off on the ice. Massive story in town today, the great chase. Ovi, 4 goals from tying Wayne Gretzky, 5 from surpassing him on the all-time goals list. We'll get to that in a second with Bailey Johnson of the Washington Post. But Bailey, I actually want to begin with the Ryan Leonard debut. Tell Caps fans who Ryan Leonard is and why tonight is so exciting.
Yeah, it's a big day for Caps fans. One of the most hyped prospects to make his debut for the Capitals in a long time. Certainly in the 2 years that I've been here, but dating back well before that. They drafted Leonard with the 8th overall pick in 2023. He played 2 years at Boston College, won 2 gold medals at the under-20 World Championships, is a lights-out goal scorer, plays with an edge, has always said that Tom Wilson is a guy that he models his game after, and now he's one of Tom Wilson's teammates.
This jump is unbelievable, and it sounds like he's going to skate with the more or less the top line, Bailey. This is pretty remarkable, no?
It is and it isn't. I mean, he's such a skilled player that starting him off in a fourth-line role isn't probably the best way to serve his talent. So, yes, he'll start tonight's game with Dylan Strome and Alexi Protas. Depending on whether you call that the top line or the Ovechkin-Dubois line the top line, you know, opinions vary, but certainly he's playing a top six role with 2 talented players. Spencer Carberry said it was important that they start him off in the top six, you know, befitting of a skill player like him, and also with 2 players who are really intelligent, really know the systems well. It can kind of help him out in his first game in Strome and Protas.
What do you expect to see from him tonight?
I think he's going to be going a million miles an hour, that's for sure. That's always what you see from guys in their debut, and there's so many emotions for him. I mean, he's from Massachusetts. All of his Boston College teammates are going to be here. Tons of friends and family coming in from Amherst. So there's so much going on. I mean, you love to see a guy score a goal in their debut, but you can't put that as an expectation. High-end prospects like this who come in tend to, again, be kind of flying like they're shot out of a cannon. They don't necessarily really have any idea of the systems, and how could they? He's had one meeting and one optional morning skate to get to know everything, but the expectation from the team is that he competes hard and is himself. And if there's one thing I know about Ryan Leonard, it's that competing hard is who he is. So I would certainly expect to see that.
Let's talk about this Ovechkin fella. I'm out of hyperbole. Nothing ceases to amaze. Here we are. It's not a bunch of gimmicks either. It's not for a fringe playoff team or a group of aging veterans that are outside looking in, just trying to feed the guy so that he scores. It's meaningful goals for a team chasing the President's Trophy, potentially a Stanley Cup. Just where are we at in terms of this chase, and try to quantify it for us?
It is, and I think the point you made about the meaningful goals is the right one, because I think it almost had to be that way. Ovechkin has always known that the way that he makes the Capitals better is by scoring goals. So, when he's always been so single-mindedly focused on scoring, it's yes, because he loves to score goals, but it's also because he knows that's the best way he can help the team. That's what he does. He scores goals. So for him to be scoring these meaningful goals for a good team as he chases the record, it feels both narratively correct and also just from a hockey standpoint how it was going to have to go if the Capitals wanted to be competitive down the stretch of his career. Obviously you want him to be a big part of it, and what he's doing at 39 years old is pretty remarkable. He's obviously not tailed off but hasn't had quite the same pace over the last couple of months that he did before he broke his leg in November, but the fact that he's scoring goals at all after breaking his leg in the middle of the season is still remarkable, which is sometimes hard to remember when he's so incredible at everything he does and is such a unicorn in the way that he plays. But yeah, 5 goals away, they've got 9 games left. Carberry mentioned this morning that he thinks adding Leonard to the lineup will give everybody a boost. You saw Ovechkin take Leonard out to dinner last night along with some of the other Capitals, and a little bit of young energy never hurts anybody, so I wouldn't be surprised if Ovi looks a little brighter as well.
Yeah, that's a part of this that I am very excited about. I think he's going to give him a shot in the arm. Billy Johnson of the Post is with us on Grant and Danny. A lot's been made of this 3-game losing streak. I want to know what you disagree with here. The Jets game, I was actually impressed and felt good about. It's a great team on the road. They went to overtime. I thought they played a bad second period against the Wild, but otherwise it was a hockey game against a hungrier team. And then the Sabres game at home was the clunker and the dud and the kind of one I need you to apologize for, so to speak. But overall, not much more to take out of it than that. What are your thoughts, and is this in any way problematic here with 9 to go?
No, I would say I pretty much agree with those general summaries. Obviously, Winnipeg's a great team. They played them toe-to-toe, lost in overtime. That's pretty not expected, but you take that. Minnesota, like you said, hungry team. They played 2 good periods and 1 not so good. And then, the Buffalo game wasn't good. They know it wasn't good. This team has struggled with the Sabres for the 2 years that I've been here. I vividly remember going to Buffalo twice, about a week and a half apart last April, and watching a team desperately trying to make the playoffs lose 2 ugly games to the Sabres. They have a hard time with those sort of run-and-gun, high-skill teams, even though the Sabres aren't a super competitive team top to bottom. They do have some really, really high-end individual skill, and when the Capitals get into those sort of up-and-down-the-ice, back-and-forth games, they tend to struggle. Spencer referred to his team as having kind of a mental block when it comes to playing those teams. It's like they forget that they are at their best when they play a heavy, high forecheck, intense, structured game and try to go toe-to-toe with a team that's built to play off the rush like the Sabres, and it all falls apart on them. So it's probably a reminder they needed heading into down the stretch, but I wouldn't be overly concerned about it by any means.
Bailey, thank you as always. Talk soon.
Thanks, guys.
Let's hit that national sounder, please, Darius. Our guy Bobby Blanco covers the Nationals. That's why he's going to talk about the Nationals right now. Bobby, did not look good when Mike Soroka came off the mound yesterday. What do we know?
No, it didn't. It's a big, scare, jolt to the heart when you see a pitcher kind of shake his arm or like flex his hand like that. But he and Davey Martinez told reporters in Toronto after the game that it seems like it's just cramps, which is a big sigh of relief. It seems like they dodged a huge bullet because, with DJ Hirsch already being pretty much lost for the season, we assume, if they lose a starting pitcher, the next guy up will be Shinosuke Ogasawara, maybe Jackson Rutledge. I don't know. Their pitching depth started off really well to begin the season, and if one guy goes down, it kind of draws a big concern. But looks like the Nats dodged a huge bullet for now.
Yeah, I think for me, it's awesome that he's not hurt and that he'll be back in the rotation soon, according to what they're saying, although I'm a see-it-to-believe-it guy sometimes when they talk about injuries. But what happened last night was a realization about how little depth they have. With Josiah Gray hurt, DJ Hurz hurt, Cade Cavalli not back yet. Now if Sirocco or anybody else were to go down, they don't really have reinforcements. Their pitching depth is paper thin, and it's April 1st.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's kind of, you know, like I was saying, like last night, that might have been one of the first alarms. Entering spring training, you had pretty much your four guys who you knew was going to make the rotation. You had three guys battling for one of those spots. Mitchell Parker ends up winning it out. But now DJ Hurz likely can be gone for the season. And I mentioned Shinosuke Ogasawara. He didn't look all that great in spring training. He still has some adjustments to do coming over from Japan and to pitching into the major leagues and now AAA. And then, you know, we know kind of what Jackson Rutledge brings to the table. Brad Lord wasn't stretched back out as a starter. He's in the bullpen right now. He's had a tough go to begin his major league career. And all the Nats' top pitching prospects are at the lower levels of the minor leagues. We're talking about Travis Sikora, who we know season's going to start a little bit late due to off-season surgery. And then Alex Clemmie, who they got in a trade last year, also starting low. Yarlin Susana hasn't pitched at AA yet. So all of their top pitching prospects that have a lot of upside are still very young and very raw, so they're not major league ready yet. The depth for the rotation at the major league level and the high upper levels of the minor leagues is very thin right now.
Incredibly small sample, talking about four games, but there are a few guys really struggling to square the baseball up. Dylan Cruz, Josh Bell, even though he does have a home run there early on. It was good to see Abrams get on the board last night with a bolt, but Cruz and Bell most specifically, operation doesn't look real good when they're making passes at the baseball, Bobby.
Yeah, it doesn't, and I get it's concerning, especially when it comes to Cruz. You know, here's a guy who's supposed to be one of their star players this year, you know, potential rookie of the year candidate, a guy that's going to be one of their best players for a long time to come. And, you know, he had a stretch over the weekend against the Phillies where he struck out, I think it was seven times in a row, and five of those came on three pitches. And he just felt completely lost. Now, I will give the Phillies pitchers credit. Some of those pitches were on the money, and no one's hitting those, not even, you know, some of the best hitters in the league.
Right, right.
But when you see him kind of pressing up there, you know, when he falls behind 0-1, 0-2, and now he's like, oh, well, I got to put a ball in play, and then he's just swinging at everything. I think pitchers can kind of pick up on that and can kind of get him to chase on that last pitch. So he really needs to settle in a little bit, kind of see his pitches, take his walks. He did so well that spring training of, you know, waiting for his pitch and using the middle of the field, and then also getting on base via walks. He really just kind of needs to hopefully take a breath and settle down. And for Josh Bell, I mean, he's admitted, you know, he understands that he was brought in to hit for power, hit for home runs. He's also admitted that, yes, the strikeout numbers will probably be high, but if the home run numbers are also high, you know, I think he will live with that. I think the Nationals will live with that. So the big home run on Sunday, that was a good sight to see, along with Nathaniel Lowe. If those guys keep hitting bombs like that, I think that's going to be a good time for this Nationals offense.
Highlight for the Nats last night, C.J. Abrams and James Wood hitting first and second in the order, going back-to-back with home runs in the game. Abrams' first of the year. Wood had a two-hit, you know, on-base three-time performance with his first home run of the season as well. But to Bobby's point, 0 for 15 with 10 strikeouts. They got to get Dylan Cruz going. He did sting a ball to the center field.
Yeah, he hit that ball.
You know, dead red, just couldn't have hit it on the screws anymore. So maybe that gets him going a little bit. Bobby, thank you, buddy. We appreciate you.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me. Enjoy the day.
See you, brother.
You got it. He didn't miss a home run by much.
Mm-mm.
If he had one of those torpedo bats,
here we go.
Maybe it would have left the building, huh? Let's keep it moving. Michael Phillips, the Richmonder and Odyssey Richmond. Michael, today, Dan Quinn said Brandon Coleman will not play guard, but he's going to get a chance first at right tackle. What do you think about that?
And then they kind of half walk it back with also Wiley's going to start at tackle, too, and we'll see what happens during training camp. I kind of expect Wiley to be moved to guard when the dust settles here. I think that's their vision for it. I think Brandon Coleman could be good out there. I think when Adam Peters locks in on something, I think he sees – like, that's what he wants to follow through with. I think he sees Coleman as a tackle. Kinlaw is a great example of that. I wish anybody in my life loved me as much as Adam Peters loves Javon Kinlaw. I mean, you know, when he's got a guy, he is set on going to bat for that guy, and I think he sees Coleman as a tackle.
I wanted to ask you about that, Miguel. This Javon Kinlaw thing, I wish my wife looked at me that way. You know what I mean? Like it's not the tolerance, but the admiration. You could hear it in his voice. Peter's talking about Kinlaw. The production simply hasn't been there. Now I understand. You know, he's part of the group that drafted him. He loves the traits and wouldn't stop talking about how massive a guy Kinlaw was in the physical presence. But again, the numbers and the production simply haven't been there for him. What do you make of that?
So did he flame out with like a really good team last year? No. I don't get it either. This is the ultimate test. I live by in Peters I trust, right? Whatever he does, I'm for it generally because I think, you know, it's probably going to be a good radio take for me long term. Like if you have me on draft night right after the pick. Like,
you're going to love that pick,
What do you think of the pick? I love it. What do you love about it? Love that Adam Peters wrote his name on a card and gave it to the commissioner. That was my favorite part of that pick. I trust him. I don't get this at all. The production clearly says this is a bad idea, and not just a bad idea, but then you go long-term with guaranteed money. I'm left scratching my head. I'm going to have to go kind of blind faith and trust here that this guy knows what he's doing, and certainly the track record last year is very favorable to that.
Yeah, I trust Barry Bonds a ton too, but he would get out about 7 times out of 10, right? Adam Peters is in a business where you don't bat 1,000, so we're always trying to figure out what's going to be right and what's going to be wrong. And while I am team, you know, love Adam Peters, he's a handsome gentleman, I like his beard, I guess I'm not quite like the Enron we trust thing is I couldn't do that. I trust Adam Peters, but I'm not going to just give him a carte blanche opening, which is where I get to the next phase of this conversation, which is their draft class last year did some good things. It was fine. But Ben Sinnott was a top 50 pick. They got nothing out of him. Luke McCaffrey was a top 100 pick, wide receiver, third round. They got next to nothing out of him as a wide receiver. Do you think that both of those guys or either of those guys ends up being mainstays, key contributors this year? Because if not, then it won't look like wins where they got those guys at the end of the year.
Yeah, I think the odds are better on McCaffrey. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they draft an impact tight end and go back to that well. It's a really important position. It's tough to find impact guys in free agency and through other methods. So, if they draft one, I think that's going to tell you a lot about what they think about Sinnott, which is, you didn't hear the glowing reviews. With McCaffrey, you could see a year two jump. I think there's certainly a history of guys who make a year two jump in the league, who it clicks, they put it together. Certainly, a complicated offense. Cliff Kingsbury's throwing a lot of concepts out there. Everybody really wanted it to work as the season went on. It just didn't. It wasn't clicking for McCaffrey. I'm going to give him another year, another training camp, see what he brings to the table. I'm leery of Sinnott, though. I mean, I didn't see the things I wanted to see last year for sure. And, that's a position that's a really important one. And you got to assume this is the last ride for Zach Ertz. So it's going to be really important to have that future locked down, especially for Jaden Daniels. That's a position he needs to get production out of on a week in, week out basis. Both those guys I got my eye on. I think McCaffrey's probably got the better odds of breaking out this year.
Michael, thank you as always, buddy. Talk soon.
Take care, guys.
He's a good egg. He's our buddy. He's Michael Phillips, the Richmonder. Check him out. And Odyssey Richmond. Next on Grant and Danny, one of the biggest, most talked about stories in sports the last few days, the torpedo bat. Is this actually a thing? Is it a fad? Is it going to change the game? We'll dive into that on The Fan. The two most used, searched, written, spoken words in baseball and maybe in all of sports the last few days, torpedo bat. The torpedo bat is the rage. I was thinking about as a sports fan, how funny it is. You know, a month ago, who can predict what the stories are going to be in the season?
Right.
But, you know, a few years ago, it was the spider attack, and you go back over certain years, and you're like, oh, that was the year in the NFL of the pandemic season. This could end up being the torpedo bat season. Or this could be something 3 months from now we have not thought about since early April, because it could be a couple-of-day blip on the radar. So as we like to do generally, I want to set this up by just explaining for the people who have no idea what's going on, what the torpedo bat is, and then I think there's a good conversation you and I can have here. We could peel back the layers of the onion and dive deep into this thing. So the Yankees hit a lot of home runs. They hit them with whatever bat they use. If you gave them a toothpick, they'd hit some damn home runs in that ballpark, okay? Aaron Judge, as an example, on Saturday hit 3 home runs in a game without a torpedo bat. He was using a normal bat. But it came to the attention of everybody watching and viewing the game and went viral on social media thanks to their play-by-play guy, Michael Kay, their Bob Carpenter, who, in the midst of a 20-run outburst where they hit a franchise record 9 home runs, on their telecast, they showed what appeared to be a gigantic-looking, like, wiffle ball bat you'd give your kid, one of those big plastic bats. And it's on the back shoulder of one of the Yankee sluggers. I don't remember who specifically was at the plate, but let's say it's Volpe. And Anthony Volpe's at the dish, and the call, Michael Kay, says, if you look at this big bat he's using here, he's using this because the Yankees had a coach last year who was a rocket scientist who realized that if you put more wood on the barrel at the part of the bat where the ball contacts the bat more often, it would travel further. The pitch swung on and crushed again. And so he's telling this story, and they're hitting all the home runs. The idea is this bat is called a torpedo bat. The way that it works is forever, Danny. The biggest part of a bat that you played with, wood bat, that anyone's ever seen, is toward the end of the bat. It gets bigger as you get toward the end, right?
Yes.
These torpedo bats are not that way. They are their biggest at the barrel. So if you're holding and looking at a bat, what you want to hit, where you want to hit the ball to square it up is on the barrel. That's never been the biggest part of the bat. It's beyond that, down toward the end of the bat, where you don't want to hit. So this guy, and I'll tell you who he is and what his whole deal is, but his name's Aaron Lenhart, who worked for the Yankees last year. He is actually, like, quite literally a scientist, right? He came up with this philosophy of saying, wait a second, if we're all chasing barrels and we're all chasing exit velocity and the whole point is to square the ball up and now we're looking at barrel percentages in organization, well, why don't we have that be the biggest part of the bat with the most wood? So this dude who has a degree in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT.
He's an MIT guy, yeah.
Physicist turned baseball coach. Basically went to the bat companies and said, let's make this bat. And now they have long enough that Giancarlo Stanton used it in the playoffs, we just found out, when he went ham sandwich in October. And 6 of the Yankees are using it, and they're killing the ball. And so everyone is going, well, wait a second, is this going to change baseball forever? Or is it just that the Brewers made a lot of terrible pitches, the Yankees hit some home runs, and this is overblown?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So I asked this question in the summer of 1999 playing in Waynesboro in the Shenandoah Valley League. Why is it that when you're trying to square the ball up on with a round bat, there's the space just above the trademark, if you know how your wood bats go, and then the very end, which is, as you said, the thickest, the largest diameter of the bat, that's the part that I'm trying to hit it is smaller, a smaller surface area than the top where I don't want to hit it. Why wouldn't we have a reinforcement here? Why wouldn't it be different
here? Asked this question.
Yes.
You're a real Aaron Lenhart. Look at you.
No.
Danny cracked the case.
I did not, because there's nothing you could do about it. The point is, there's been no innovation until, you know, it was revolutionary when Barry Bonds started using maple. Everyone had used the same ash or a couple, you know, derivations or different kinds of wood. Nobody ever done anything different. And now all of a sudden, oh, he's got maple. It's so different. This is just the latest. Now, let me rephrase. Somebody finally did something about the fact that you could basically order one of three models. There are three what are called bat turns, the way that they take this piece of lumber, the piece of the tree, that's got good enough grains as you look vertically on the bat. You want a nice grain that's even. You don't want too many grains. It means the wood's lower quality, but there's a certain fine thing that you find, okay? It's a 243. A 271 and a 110. Now, why they're called that, I have no idea. But one is basically more uniform. That's the 110. That's very balanced. The 271 is the most common model used by every hitter that's ever hit with a wood bat. The 243 was the big advancement like 70 years ago. Thin handle, fatter barrel. So those are more susceptible to breakage. You get jammed. You hit off the top. There's less wood close to the handle where your hands are, which means that bat can break more frequently. But it's end loaded, so it's a trade-off that you make. That's the key term, by the way. Trade-off. Doesn't guarantee anything. There's no homing signal in the middle of this wood. They're not adding a second layer of wood inside the bat. They're not reinforcing. It's not corked. All they're doing is simply saying, when you put that wood, that big piece that we're going to start from, it could be a chair leg or it could be a wood bat, when you're sanding it down with the spins, with the turns, you just sand less in the spot where you're going to make contact the
so
most.
So I texted my buddy last night. There's a pitcher with the Orioles, Kyle Gibson, and he said essentially that he needs more information before he has any kind of real opinion on this. But his take was that this is going to blow over, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he seems to think that this is overhyped because his point is you could miss hit balls off the end of the bat that you can't with this bat.
Correct.
So, yes, if you square it up and hit it on the barrel, this is a good bat for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you used to get jammed a bunch down toward the bottom of the barrel, so to speak,
yes,
this is a perfect bat for you. But if you're a guy that often hits the ball off the end of the bat or down further away from you, edge of the barrel, so to speak, this is bad for you because the miss hit that may have had exit velocity to get into the gap, like James Wood could do or something, mm-hmm. or you know, a ball that maybe falls in as a jam shot, you get nothing on and now is a weak pop out. And his point is, you're just redistributing the weight on the bat.
That's it.
Now, the rules in baseball are very simple on this. Bats have to be a certain length, range. They can be from X to Y, but they cannot be longer than Y. Okay,
you can't use like a chair leg, you know, or like a telephone pole.
You also, from a width standpoint, with a baseball bat, have to be smaller than the width that is allowed. And these bats, even though they look crazy fat, they look so much bigger than a normal bat mm-hmm. is. They are still within the range of what is allowed in terms of the width of a baseball bat. So baseball approved them. They have to be approved to be used in game. The manufacturers can't manufacture en masse and send them to the players until they get approved, and they have been. They're so popular now that these orders all over the country, from high schoolers and college kids now this week to baseball players all over the big leagues who want to start experimenting and just hitting with them in BP.
Yep.
Supposedly, and I'll play audio next segment from Phillies infielder Bryson Stott about this, but like the idea is you shouldn't be able, in his opinion, to just order the bat and then use it in a game because it's not for everyone. You can do that. But his point is, I went this offseason, because it's been around since last year. Most people inside baseball knew about it. We all kind of find out about it this week.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, I went to my lab where they create my bats. There are actual engineers there that work with
them. They hook you up to these harnesses that looks like they're trying to diagnose what's wrong with you. But it's totally like they're measuring your biomechanical energy and motion and everything else.
And he swung a bat 1,000 times. And they watch where the ball hits on every pitch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they monitor. They go, okay, this is where you often swing and miss on this pitch, that pitch. And it's enough swings over a day or two where they get all this data and they tell you this is the part of the bat where you often hit the ball. And that's theoretically where you could customize and have the bigger part of the bat for this torpedo bat.
Mm-hmm.
But his point is everyone swings a little bit different. This will work differently for everybody. Just to go get it because the Yankees hit some home runs is crazy talk.
Right.
Like that is not what people should be doing. Now, there are players I saw all over the sport TV, radio, in print yesterday who are saying after seeing this, They ordered some. They asked their company, ship me some so that I could see what this is all about. So this is a growing thing, and I guess my question to our listeners is, A, it looks so aesthetically odd. To me, it looks like it shouldn't be allowed because the bats are huge. I know that they're within the realm of the rules. Do you have any issue with this? Because it's basically been happening for years and years and years, like the redistribution of weight on a bat. 800-636-1067. And then the other question is, do you think this is a fad or do you think this is going to change the game? Like 5 years from now, are we going the torpedo bat era where everyone's now using that? Because to your point, if you look at a timeline of like bat tech over 30 years, Danny, there's almost nothing.
There's nothing.
It's like you used the great example that's in this story that I'm sure you read from the New York Times, where they basically said everyone used a type of wood. And then Barry Bonds used a different type of wood, and everyone said, oh, my God, I'm going to use that. Like, Jazz Chisholm from the Yankees, who's off to a great start using the torpedo bat,
mm-hmm.
he had not used one of these bats. And then in-game, he grabbed somebody's bat in spring training. I can't remember whose it was that I read last night. But let's say it's, you know, Austin Wells or something. He grabs his bat. He hits 2 at-bats, home run and a double, and he said, I'm using this bat.
This is what I use, yeah.
And that's how finicky some of these guys think, right? Mm-hmm. But this is fascinating to me. I know this is nerd stuff. I hope it's not too nerdy, but I think this is so interesting. We'll open up the phones, 800-636-1067.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm fascinated by it. And again, there have been so many violent shoves forward in terms of innovation, and they've all been pitching, quite frankly, when it comes to it. Guys have different pieces of equipment now to make themselves protected. Like, I remember it was weird first seeing Jeff Bagwell with the pads on his hands. Remember those? Like, on the back of his batting gloves that he had custom built because he got hit in the hands so much. And that was like, what is going on? And now it looks like guys are, you know, RoboCop going up there with the shin protector, the arm protector, being able to dive out over the plate to, you know, try to protect themselves and, you know, not get thrown out or not get plunked and have their careers altered, right? But you look at all the pitching, everything that's happened. Guys are in the lab biomechanically engineering themselves and figuring out how to supinate their pronators, and these little, you know, guys that would have thrown 85 with movement 10 years ago are now, everybody throws 100. Right? There's no Tom Glavine. There's no Greg Maddux. So in order to kind of compete, you need to maximize. So I remember that from my own meager career, I broke a couple of bats in the first month I was playing with wood bats my freshman summer, right? And I just picked up, hey, this is the model for you. You hit some home runs your freshman year. You hit pretty well freshman year with the aluminum. Here, use this. It's a 243 model. I'm going, why am I breaking bats going up against good pitching? And it was, I hit off the hands, that shattered one. Hit off the top, I shattered one. And so I'm going through too many bats. So you need to switch models. I switched to an M110, more balanced. I sacrificed some power, but I'm able to make more consistent contact. That's what I used. So what this is doing, it doesn't cure anything. It doesn't fix anything. It simply maximizes your efficiency if you're a certain kind of guy. Paul Goldschmidt went, and it was a big story about a couple years ago, to that same lab or one of these labs, and they put this extra weight on the knob of his bat. That's an extra piece on the bat. Ellie De La Cruz had that. David Martinez made it take it off, then he hit a bomb. But, yeah, but those extra pieces are different than just bats cut differently.
Those they weren't allowed to use because you're like adding something to it. Mm-hmm. It does feel like, though, you if you're changing the technology, it's as if you like bring your own pitching balls to the game, and now you've doctored and changed the pitching balls to help exacerbate what you do well. Again, it is within the rules. It is legal. What I'm asking people, though, is are you cool with it? Does it feel right? To me, when I first heard about this and I saw the bats, they look so big and goofy, I thought, they should not be allowed. Why are we doing this? Now, as I've read and actually gotten the information and dug way deeper into this, I don't have a big problem with the bats, if I'm being honest, but I also don't think they're making as big an impact maybe as people think. But this all started with this guy, Aaron Leanhart, who said in a phone interview with the New York Times, he asked the question to players, where are you trying to make contact? And they all said, well, I want to barrel it. He's going, well, why wouldn't we make the bat the biggest with the most wood on the barrel then? And he began his work when he was a member of the Yankees minor league hitting department in 2022. It's taken 3 years, and now it's all the rage. Volpe, Bellinger, among others, using this bat in-game. Judge says he never will. He's not going to fix something that's not broken.
Please don't do anything different, Aaron Judge.
This is the audio I was referencing, though. Philly's Bryson Stott, when he was going into the specifics on why he didn't plan on just picking up the making a call and you know, just having a new bat that he uses this season because other guys are hitting home runs.
Sure, you've heard about the torpedo bats that the Yankees have been using. Vic just said today that might be something you guys implement. Have you guys discussed that as a team or...
A little bit, yeah. I texted Jared at Victus, and I was telling Todd earlier that it's not a bat that they've been around. It's not a new thing. It's been around, and it's not a thing you could just go and order. Marucci and Victus have a hit lab, they call it, and connect all these wires to you. You swing 1,000 bats, and they kind of tell you where you're hitting the ball mostly and things like that. So if you're a guy who uses the whole bat, if you get jammed and hit it on the end and hit the barrel, it's not for you. You've taken wood off the end of the bat and shrinking that part, and it's a lot of stuff that goes into it. So
pause it real quick. I think that's important. You're not adding wood to the bat. It's not heavier necessarily.
Right. That's the mistake everybody's making.
Mm-hmm. Like the end of the bat, it looks more like a bowling pin almost. Mm-hmm. The end of the bat is smaller than it used to be because the middle of the bat or the barrel is heavier. Well, bigger.
It's a lot of stuff that goes into it. So I think with the torpedo, you are more like you get jammed more than hit it off the end. And then it helps. Obviously, you're moving the barrel down a little bit. And but it's not one of those things you could just call and say, I want this torpedo because it might not work for you. So
so that's interesting. It's an individualized thing and it's about your swing. And as he said, you're going to want to go to the lab and take 1,000 swings to figure out if this will even work.
It's worth a shot for you to feel like if it works. Again, there are so many different models that guys are already switching between where it's like, hey, this month I'm killing the ball because they're throwing me the outer half. Well, now they're sawing me off and I'm breaking a bat a week. I better switch it up. And that's a normal part of it.
Fad or unbelievable innovation that is going to change the sport? That's kind of what I want to figure out. 800-636-1067 is the number on Grant and Danny.
See the shape of Chisholm's bat?
I do. It's got a big barrel on it.
Well, it's actually a little bit lower than the barrel. The Yankee front office, the analytics department, did a study on Anthony Volpe, and every single ball, it seemed like he hit on the label. He didn't hit any on the barrel. So they had bats made up where they moved a lot of the wood into the label, so the harder part of the bat is going to actually strike the ball.
That'd be a weird way to hit. Going up there expecting to get jammed and putting the meat of the bat towards the label?
It'd allow you to wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, you'd wait all right.
One of the things I do love about the torpedo bat discussions of the last few days now is how you just tell new school, old school. When you hear some of these commentators who played 30, 40 years ago mm-hmm. in their old school, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. The people that just immediately out themselves. What was I watching the other day where analytics came up? Oh, it was my guy, Alan May, who I actually like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like on television on Monumental, and they showed something with like expected goals against or added. He's like, I don't care about that. I don't know what it is, and I'm not even going to mention it. It was like on a graphic or something. I'm just like, just outing people who, it's just information.
Yeah.
We don't have to be scared of data and information. Like, there's no reason to run from it. The Yankees have already hit 16 home runs. They hit a lot of home runs with or without the torpedo bat. Danny, is this a fad? Is this a hot thing for a couple of days that'll go away? Or has baseball changed in front of our eyes?
I think it's changed. And I think it's, again, there's been so little innovation when it comes to bats and bat technology over decades. So I think this is actually a new, smart way to do it. So, because again, it was the same.
So you think this is a game changer that like 10 years from now, the majority of hitters will be using torpedo bats?
I don't think so. I don't think it's a game changer necessarily. I don't think it's what spider tack was or other forms of cheating. Because this is not cheating. This is just a smart use of the same amount of wood, just reapplied in a different way. So I do think it's an innovation finally in that regard.
This is so simple though. This guy Leanhart, this 48-year-old astrophysicist dude that became a coach or whatever. How did it take him? Like, this is the most common sense thing ever. If the bat's a little bigger at that spot, you're going to get louder, better contact.
Mm-hmm.
MLB Rule 3.02 states a bat shall be smooth, round, stick, not more than 2.61 inches in diameter at the thickest part and not more than 42 inches in length. Otherwise, have fun. How has this not been something people were experimenting with for a long time?
100%.
And I know we now can quantify barrel rate, barrel percentage, exit velocity, and I think that's all part of why this happened. But that's a few years ago we started doing
it. And I'll say this really quickly. I know we got calls. It's the mass production, because that's what it has to be. It's mass production of these things. You think about just the number of big leaguers, then every wood bat for kids, high school, college, different summer leagues. Because this takes more individual painstaking care to do it this way, before we had like the rampant technology to be able to do some of these things, it's why there wasn't any innovation, right? Because if you're making a Grant Paulson major leaguer, you're ordering bats, I'm giving you 30. Well, you do that times the 26 guys in the clubhouse or whatever, everybody needs their bat, blah, blah, blah. I got to produce tens of thousands of those things. I don't have time to start hand cutting stuff. Now with the processes faster and more efficient, they can do some more individual stuff.
Yeah, I've actually listened recently, and this was apropos of nothing. This had nothing to do with these bats, but there's a podcast I listened to about like how companies get off the ground. And Marucci, which mm-hmm. is now the biggest company that's overtaken Louisville Slugger.
Incredible their growth.
They
yeah.
started just with bats. Now it's gloves, mm-hmm. cleats, you name it. They
Cat X is ubiquitous for high
They're
school
They're in softball,
yeah.
everything. But it started by Kurt Ainsworth, who's a former pitcher for the Orioles, who went to LSU. He's out of Baton Rouge. And anyway, it was a fascinating, but they talked about the painstaking operation of actually mm-hmm. getting off the ground, making bats, to your point. Let's go to Chris in Hyattsville on Grant and Danny. What do you guys think of this torpedo bat conversation in baseball?
Grant, you make a lot of really interesting points. I think this is going to be a game changer. And like you said, it sounds so logical. You wonder why they didn't think of this 50 years ago. There is an interesting point that not every batter hits the majority of balls on the label. But if you just think about it logically, and Danny can tell you this, every kid is taught check swing to make sure your bat location covers the plate. Well, when you do that, you know, the barrel is off to the right half of the plate.
Mm-hmm.
So half of the bat is you're going to make contact on the label. It would make more sense to recenter that to get more density and get more pop. Is it going to work for every batter? I don't know, but I think it's going to work for probably a majority of batters. And I just think it's impressive that they came up with this and no one else thought of it. It's kind of ingenious.
It's wild. It's so simple and yet so genius. Just looking at barrel percentage in baseball. So the guys that hit the barrel the most often, and this is based on the 2024 numbers, so a full season last year. What percentage of the time do you think the leader in the sport, Aaron Judge, hit, you know, barreled it?
Oh, gosh. 34, 35%?
So 27%.
Oh, lower than that. Yeah,
so,
wow.
So my point is, you don't hit the barrel as often as you think.
Right.
So if you're using this bat that is great for when you hit the barrel, mm-hmm. that means a lot more often it's going to screw you up more than it helps you. That said, if you're Judge, if you're Otani, if you're Stanton, if you're Soto, these are the exit velocity kings, right? If you're some other guys that aren't on that level, like Nolan Gorman of the Cardinals, Tyler O'Neill now with the Orioles, Michael Toglia, first baseman Rockies, Brent Rooker A's. I don't see any Nationals on this list, regrettably.
What? Really?
But these guys that barrel the baseball really high rate,
mm-hmm.
this could be perfect for you. Russ in Alexandria, how are you?
Hey, first time, I just picked my sign up from daycare. First time caller, love the show.
Thank you, man.
Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray!
You know, my kind of point on this is, I think if it does change the game and people are scoring like 18, 20 runs a game, didn't we just change the pitch clock and all these things to make games, you know, 2 hours instead of like three and a half hours long? If it changes the game, are they going to cut the innings down to like seven? Like, how are they going to deal with that?
It's a great question. Stick aside, it's not going to result in 20 runs a game. We're not in the steroid era in the late 90s.
No, but if runs are up, you know, a half run, that's a massive difference.
It's a huge deal, and you might see it. Here's my response, though. I don't think necessarily it's about – I know everybody points to the cutting down times of game as the essential thing. To me, it was the elimination of the nothing is happening for extended periods of time part. And a corollary of that is, okay, the games are going to be shorter now. So in other words, instead of, all right, now the shortstop jogs in to talk to the pitcher. Then the catcher comes out and does a visit on the mound. Then here comes the pitching coach, just so the lefty specials can warm up and get hot for the next batter. We're cutting out those 3, 4, 5 minutes where nothing's happening. It's to keep action going. They want action. They want stolen bases. They want hits. They want runs. So they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. So I don't think they'll view it as a problem. If we start adding 15, 20 some minutes and it's a, you know, it's a 4.5 hour Red Sox Yankees game, like again, it's the early 2000s, maybe there's an adjustment coming, but I think you're far away from that.
Well, remember, the baseballs were wound tighter and flew like golf balls, and that led to more home runs, which baseball was happy about. Maybe they're going to be thrilled about this. 800-636-1067. Do you think this will change baseball forever, or is this something that a month from now will go, what were those things called again? The bats the Yankees were using, everyone was talking about? Torpedo bats. Vic, our buddy, who's one of the engineers for Nats Baseball, Slick Vic Ferreira, you may know him as, he texted me and said, torpedo bats are the new tush push.
Oh,
which
no.
Which is just kind of a funny thing.
Oh, no.
Everyone's going to want to get rid of the torpedo bats. G&D on the fan.